Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for April 11th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, the hot climate of the Cretaceous period, new treatments for alcoholism, drugs that may prevent and mitigate damage caused by radiation, and Generation Y enters the scientific workforce. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Super greenhouse temperatures in the geologic past meant higher ocean temperatures and less of a temperature gradient by latitude, meaning there wasn't as much difference between tropical and polar temperatures as today. In a paper in this week's Science, Lee Kump and David Pollard describe a new model for how the Earth got so hot, in particular, by taking into account cloud albedo, or how much of the sun's radiation is reflected back into space. What accounts for the less dense cloud cover that permits more solar radiation to reach the Earth? Fewer biogenic cloud condensing nuclei, on which water droplets form. I spoke with Kump from his office at Pennsylvania State University.
So we've proposed a mechanism that could lead to a reduction in cloud albedo and cloud amount that leads to substantial warming.
And in your team models, these less dense clouds mean higher temperatures? Why is that?
Yes, because cloud reflectivity is an integral property of the cloud. And so we have a lower density of cloud droplets in the cloud, and that means that in the path of light as it's penetrating through the cloud, there's less interaction with reflective cloud particles. And so a greater penetration of the solar radiation through the cloud leads to substantial warming. The other surprise that we had is that it's not just the cloud number, but it's the droplet size. And we run into sort of a wall exponential change in cloud droplet residence time as a function of size, whereas the droplets get larger and larger as there are fewer and fewer of these cloud condensation nuclei present, the residence time in the atmosphere goes down and goes down markedly and in a nonlinear fashion. And so as we push the cloud droplet radius larger as a result of imposing fewer of these biogenic cloud condensation nuclei, we end up at a point where the rainout efficiency goes up dramatically, and so there are just fewer clouds. And so the overall response in our model is a combination of these two effects, and it becomes a much larger warming effect than what we had imagined going into it.
Why would these less dense clouds form? You mentioned the decreased amount of biological nuclei for the droplets to form around. Why would that happen?
Well, and so this is a part that we haven't dealt with quantitatively. And so we begin with the premise that the warmer world of the Cretaceous or the early Eocene was less biologically productive world. And that's an assumption that needs to be evaluated more quantitatively. The idea, and it really follows from some work that's been done recently on the response of the oceans and the terrestrial biota to global warming today. And so modeling studies of the response of the oceans, for example, tend to suggest that as the oceans warm in the next few centuries, that biological productivity as a global average will decrease. And we extend that onto land by thinking about the response of terrestrial ecosystems to warming and tropical ecosystems experiencing temperatures, in excess of 35 degrees are going to likely exhibit stress, thermal stress that could well lead to lower biological productivity in those environments as well. And so our climate simulations were really looking at the end member. What if the world in the super greenhouse state was as unproductive as the least productive regions of the world today? So the subtropical oceanic gyres, where there's a very low supply of nutrients and thus presumably a very modest supply of biogenic cloud condensation nuclei. What if the world was characterized by a low biologically productive ecosystem? What would that mean for the climate? And that's where we started. And so we looked at much lower cloud condensation nuclei abundance, translating that into fewer cloud condensation nuclei, and then specify that in our climate model and looked at the climatic consequences.
Now, you had also mentioned in your model that the water droplets in these less dense clouds were larger. Was that right?
Right.
So at what point did the droplets become so big that they fall, or do the warmer temperatures mean the bigger droplets can stay up in the clouds?
No, the droplets do start to fall, and this is that surprising result that we hadn't really anticipated, that there would be this strong feedback that as the droplets get larger and larger. So first of all, the number of droplets per unit volume of atmosphere for a given relative humidity determines the size of the droplets. And if there are a lot of cloud condensation nuclei, then there are a lot of surfaces for these droplets to form on it, and so you get many small droplets. But as the number of droplets diminish, then there are fewer surfaces on which water condenses, and so it tends to condense on those fewer surfaces, and so they grow. And then you find out that as these droplets get larger, there's this nonlinear exponential increase in their tendency to fall from the atmosphere. And so as these droplets go from just a few microns, 5 or 10 microns, up toward 15 to 20 microns, their residence time in the atmosphere drops dramatically. This is characterized as a rainfall efficiency, and so the efficiency goes way up. And so the clouds basically rain out. And it's at that stage that we have this effect that it's not just the albedo or reflectivity that matters, but overall cloudiness that's reduced.
What then are the implications for climate modelers today?
Well, you know, this is one of those known unknowns that haven't yet been incorporated into climate models. So, you know, this is not a part of the typical climate model that is being used for IPCC future climate simulations, for example. And so
the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change,
right, which is the group that's been compiling published climate simulations and sort of guiding the community in terms of what types of simulations would be important. And there's certainly a recognition in the climate modeling community that we need to incorporate as many of the viable mechanisms, demonstrably functioning mechanisms in the climate system as possible, to do as good a job as we can with respect to projecting future climate. I think we're still a ways off from putting this as a fully functional feedback mechanism within coupled climate models because of the nature of this feedback that I've been describing, that there's the whole biological response to the warming that needs to be considered. And so every step of the way, there's complex biology and chemistry going on. And we've compacted that all into a black box and studied and said, well, if in fact a warmer world is less productive and a less productive world produces fewer cloud condensation nuclei, what would be the climatic implications of that? And so we've just answered one part of that question, and there's a lot that would need to be done still to put in all of these as functional attributes within a climate model so we can project into the future. But concern about future climate states arises mostly because of unexplored, unknown positive feedbacks and or thresholds in the climate system. And so we've identified a potential positive feedback, maybe one that's a very strong positive feedback, that really, I think, warrants further investigation.
Okay. Lee Kump, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lee Kump is lead author of a paper on the amplification of Cretaceous biological cloud feedbacks. Read the paper in this week's Science. Also this week in Science, conservation priorities in Madagascar. Claire Kremen and colleagues describe in a paper the conservation planning approach they took to identify the best places the Madagascar government should expand in its efforts to triple the amount of land area under protection. Instead of using the typical approach to conservation planning, which considers a small number of species and relatively large chunks of land, the team showed that high-resolution, multi-taxonomic approaches across a wide geographic area is critical for identifying areas most likely to promote the persistence of the most species. You can read the paper in this week's Science. Alcohol dependence affects millions of people worldwide. In the United States alone, 4% of the adult population are afflicted, and it is the third leading cause of preventable death. In this week's issue, Science News writer Greg Miller reports on new treatment options for those dependent on alcohol, including treatments that combine behavioral therapy with drugs.
I think there are interesting changes happening in alcoholism research. For a long time, there was this sort of idea that alcoholism is kind of a moral failing or character flaw or something like that, and that it's best remedied by willpower. And there's been a change towards thinking about what happens in the brain when someone becomes dependent on alcohol and how the chemistry of the brain changes and whether it might be possible with drugs to loosen the grip of the addiction so that people can, either through behavioral types of therapies or other means, get their life back under control. And so my article takes a look at some of the drugs that are being investigated to help people who are dependent on alcohol.
Sort of a combined approach then.
Yeah, I think like for a lot of psychiatric disorders, there's kind of an idea that the best treatment is probably going to be a combination of drugs and behavioral therapies. And the drugs in a lot of cases kind of help give the therapy a chance to work, give the behavioral therapies a chance to work.
Are there different types of drugs?
For alcoholism, there are currently three drugs that are approved. One of them is a very old drug called disulfiram or antabuse that just makes people very sick when they drink. And it doesn't work particularly well because people stop taking it if they know they're going to relapse. And then there are a couple other drugs on the market now that work pretty well for some people and not very well or maybe not even at all for other people.
What's the difference between these drugs? Are they treating different types of alcoholism?
Well, that's one possibility. There is increasing thought that there might be different types of alcoholism, that people start drinking for different reasons, and different types of alcoholics might respond better to different types of drugs.
What's an example of these different kinds of alcoholics?
Well, the terminology kind of differs, but you can think of two broad classes. One might be called reward alcoholics, people who drink because they get a big kick from alcohol, and they tend to be ones who have a family history of alcoholism, start drinking early and get into trouble with alcohol early in life. And the other broad class, which might actually turn out to be the majority, are relief drinkers, or some people call them anxious alcoholics, who drink more to relieve stress than for the rewards of drinking. And these people often start drinking later in life. They might be moderate drinkers, and then in their 30s or 40s start drinking more heavily and become dependent on it. And they tend to be ones who drink to relieve stress, either from just daily events in their life or the stress that comes with stopping drinking when your brain is dependent on it.
So are these different drugs targeting different receptors in the brain? How do these things work?
So the reward drinkers are the people who tend to respond best to a drug called naltrexone, which is approved for about 15 years now in the U.S. for treating alcoholism, and it blocks opioid receptors, which are part of the brain's reward pathway. And so some of the thinking is that because these people are getting a big reward from alcohol, if you block that, you can help them stop drinking. And there's some other drugs that are being investigated now that are in very early, very preliminary stages, but that target stress pathways in the brain, and those are showing some promise in some of these early studies for helping anxious alcoholics, people who have sort of a history of anxiety and fit that pattern of drinking.
Were these drugs developed to treat alcoholism in the first place?
In a lot of cases, no. In fact, the stress drug that I just mentioned was initially developed as a possible depression treatment. It proved safe in those clinical trials, but wasn't effective enough for the company to continue developing it for depression.
How long would a patient need to be medicated or take these drugs to curb their alcoholism?
That's a really good question, and one that I don't think we really know the answer to. It's possible that people would need to be on drugs for the rest of their lives to give them the maximum chance of not having a relapse. It might turn out to be just the sort of thing that, you know, each doctor and patient has to decide the best course. But I think the hope from all of this work is that in the next few years, we'll have more options for treating people for alcoholism, and that more people will be able to get treatment just from going to their primary care doctor or going to see a psychiatrist.
The hope being that they'll seek treatment if there are drugs out there to help treat them?
Yeah, and that there will be more treatment. Right now, most people who get treatment for alcohol abuse get it through sort of community support groups, not from their doctor. And if more drugs are available and doctors feel like they have more options to help treat people, maybe more people will get help through their physicians.
Well, Greg Miller, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Science News writer Greg Miller reports on tackling alcoholism with drugs. You can read his article in this week's Science. Also in this week's Science, the size of ancient meteorites. Because of the continuous reshaping of Earth's surface, scientists have had a hard time estimating the size and number of meteor impacts. Now, Francois Paquet and colleagues reported a paper that decreases in seawater ratio of isotopes of osmium caused by the impact of stony chondritic meteorites can be used to estimate the meteorite's size. That's because the marine osmium isotopic record may be understood as the mixing of ambient seawater osmium isotope ratios with ratios from meteoritic osmium that dissolves in the seawater after the meteorite vaporizes on impact. The authors estimate a 4 to 6 kilometer-wide meteorite hit the Earth at the end of the Cretaceous, about 65 million years ago, and a 3 kilometer-wide meteorite hit at the end of the Eocene, about 35 million years ago. You can read the paper in this week's Science. Ionizing radiation is used in therapy to kill cancerous cells, but often kills many healthy cells in the process. Now, Andrei Gudkov and colleagues report in a paper that they've developed a new drug that protects bone marrow and gastrointestinal cells from radiation without reducing the radiation's effectiveness against cancer. They did it by copying one of the ways cancer cells keep from self-destructing, a programmed process known as apoptosis that normally occurs when a cell's genome undergoes some kind of mutation. To get around apoptosis, some cancer cells deregulate the NF-kappa-B pathway, a pathway that mobilizes the cell's survival mechanisms. Gudkov and his team found that the protein flagellin also activated the NF-kappa-B pathway through toll-like receptor 5 in healthy cells. The drug, called CBLB-502, is a less immunogenic form of flagellin that the team engineered to activate the toll-like receptor and so take advantage of the cell's own NF-kappa-B pathway as a protection mechanism against radiation. I spoke to Gudkov from his office in Cleveland Biolabs in Buffalo, New York.
When we have discomfort inside, we may commit suicide. But I don't think we ever commit suicide when we meet an enemy on the dark street. On the contrary, if we had suicidal intentions, we will put them aside, deal with the enemy, and then only you can come back to your internal problems. That's exactly what is happening in the cells. An NF-kappa-B pathway mobilizes cell survival mechanisms in front of attack from outside. That is why, by definition, this mobilization occurs temporarily, and this pathway usually is activated for a couple of hours only. What tumor cells do, they deregulate this pathway in such a way, they acquire mutations which deregulate this pathway in such a way that it becomes constitutively active. So tumor cells pretend to themselves that there are plenty of viruses and bacteria around, which is usually none. And they do it because they take advantage of being resistant to apoptosis, because an NF-kappa-B may put a ban on apoptosis. And second, an NF-kappa-B does many other pleasant things for cells.
So your team tried to activate that NF-kappa-B pathway in normal cells, taking inspiration from the cancer cells, which were activating it by themselves.
Right. So the philosophy was like this. If tumor cells took advantage of activating an NF-kappa-B, and our belief is that they do it in order to avoid apoptosis, why can't we then try to imitate this trick pharmacologically by making drugs which would do it in normal cells and temporarily and reversibly turn them into resistant to apoptosis? That was the whole idea. We decided to learn from the tumor, and we followed this tumor trick.
So your team then produced NF-kappa-B pathway activator.
The issue is that you need, on one hand, to activate an NF-kappa-B in order to reach this radio resistance. But on the other hand, you don't want to have this cytokine storm, because then you will kill the patient. And the reason for activation of release of these cytokines is because they mobilize the immune system. On one hand, they attract immunocytes to the site of attack. On the other hand, they stimulate immunocytes to proliferate. And if released in a big way, these cytokines, especially some of them, can be really dangerous, because they may lead to such a cascade of activation of an NF-kappa-B in too many cells in the organism and such a huge release of the cytokines that it may lead to the process we name acute inflammation, which may be killing. And here comes into play the most important part of the discovery. I think this is probably the most critical decision we made. Because we decided to look at NF-kappa-B activating factors which are being generated by natural human microflora. Those bacteria which are residing in humans for millions of years and which passed through years of coevolution. And because of that, approached high degree of adaptation and becoming harmless. Not only harmless, but sometimes even protecting for the tissues of their natural inhabitants. And this is how we came up with the idea of using the agonist of toll-like receptor 5.
And what is that?
Toll-like receptor 5 is one of the mechanisms of activation of an NF-kappa-B. The ligand of this receptor is the flagellin of Salmonella, the protein which is produced by multiple microorganisms residing in our guts as microflora, including Escherichia coli. So flagellin is activating toll-like receptor 5 only in those cells which express this receptor. And although we didn't know much in the beginning of this work which cells express it and which not, it was already obvious that far from all the cells in the organism express it. If all cells would express it, then we would have a huge activation of NF-kappa-B, not only in those cells which we would like to protect, but also in those which we don't care about, because they're already resistant from the very beginning. Fortunately for us, toll-like receptor 5 is expressed exactly in those cells which we would like to learn how to protect, which are cells of small intestine and cells of early hematological progenitors of bone marrow.
So then your team produced a variant on this flagellin?
Yes, and after that, because flagellin is a big protein which is very immunogenic, and you do not want to treat the patient and immunize it, the patient at the same time. So you want to reduce immunogenicity of the protein you are injecting, and at the same time get rid of unnecessary property and unnecessary parts of that. So we took advantage of work done by others which analyzed the structure of flagellin, and we did protein engineering on the molecule, and we got rid of those parts of the molecule which are not essential for activation of toll-like receptor 5 signaling. As a result, we have a molecule about 2 times shorter than the original one, which is about 50 times less immunogenic than the big one, and which is stable like hell. You can boil it for 2 hours in water without changing properties.
So this was the drug that you injected into mice and monkeys?
Right.
To test out its protecting against radiation?
Yes. These resulting proteins we named CBLB502, and this is the drug prototype, drug candidate already, which we started testing massively in monkeys and in mice. And we demonstrated efficacy in both species. We demonstrated that it can be efficacious injected not only before radiation, but also after radiation. And then we went into obviously we did this all in order to approach the point when we can start applying it to humans.
Are there any concerns that this drug is keeping cells alive that would normally self-destruct because of the radiation? And so these protected cells might themselves become cancerous?
This was the biggest concern, obviously a safety concern, because the protecting those cells which otherwise should be eliminated may create a population of high risk for cancer development. However, there is accumulating knowledge in the field that temporarily and reversibly suppressing these mechanisms of apoptosis doesn't really do much to the increase of cancer risk. So that is why we suspected that this short-term shutdown of this response should not be harmful. The other reason why we thought it should not be harmful, because all of us, have this pathway activated numerous times during our life, and there was never any connection noticed between the acute inflammation and being tremendously cancerous. So we hope that it's going to be safe. But all these considerations were theoretical. We needed to have some empirical proof. And this empirical proof actually was received when we took cancer-prone mice, which had a, because of mutation, they have a reduced function of p53 pathway, which did not protect them well enough from cancer. And these mice, when you irradiate them with a sublethal dose of radiation, they develop cancer within 1 year, practically 100%, which means that if simultaneously with radiation, you would apply any type of treatment which may be carcinogenic or protective from carcinogenicity, you could easily see whether this is indeed true by monitoring the group of mice during the year to see whether they would develop cancer with different frequency or with different dynamics. So we did this experiment. We took these two groups of mice. One just received sublethal dose of radiation and developed cancer with certain dynamics within 1 year. And in parallel, similar group received similar dose of radiation, but with our TLR5 agonist, CBLB502. And then we monitored that too. And you see this in the last figure of the paper. And you see that the curves showing the frequency and dynamic of tumor development in both groups were indistinguishable, indicating that this way is absolutely safe in terms of not being cancer-promoting.
Well, Andrei Gudkov, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Andrei Gudkov is senior author of a paper on the radioprotective effects of a drug in mouse and primate models. Read the paper in this week's Science. Generation Y entered the workforce a few years ago now, and many of that generation now have doctorates and are starting their scientific careers in earnest. This week, Science Careers takes a look at these new young scientists to make sense of this new workforce and the workplace that Generation Yers are entering. Here's a preview with contributing editor Kate Travis and contributing writer Lucas Lauerson.
Generation Y are a group of headphone-wearing, job-hopping slackers.
Excuse me? We're technologically savvy, career-focused optimists. I don't blame you for that opinion. There are a lot of misconceptions about us, you know? Generation Y are millennials.
Millennials?
People who came of age in the new millennium. Not everyone agrees on the definition of Generation Y, but generally it's people born after 1980. Sorry, you don't qualify.
Excuse me, I'm Generation X, and I'm not that much older than you. How different could our generations be?
Very different, according to Rena Nadler. She's a millennial and program director of Life Course Associates, a marketing and human resources consulting company.
We've found that many millennials object to the term Gen Y because it implies that we are just an extension of Generation X. One of the messages that we think it's really important to learn about this youth generation is that we represent a very strong break from the styles and attitudes of Generation X.
Meaning you all slack off even more than we Gen Xers supposedly do?
Hardly. Instead, as Paul Redman of the University of Liverpool points out, we Generation Yers are the most educated generation to date.
They've got very strong values about things like the world and business, which mark them out as quite different from Generation X, the generation that preceded them. I think in particular the key characteristics are they're driven by change, challenge, and choice. So they like lots of variety, lots of change, and lots of choice.
Wait a minute. Aren't all these generational labels a little contrived?
That's a typical response from a Generation Xer. Yes, there may be generalizations, but we're all influenced by our surroundings. Again, here's Rena Nadler.
Certainly not every millennial is, you know, pressured and close with their parents and has been sheltered their whole life and has a high sense of happiness and confidence. That doesn't describe everybody. But that is sort of the direction in which young people are moving. The time at which you come along deeply affects who you are and what place you have in the world.
Okay, so we can make some generalizations. So then, what does Generation Y want out of a job?
For starters, we Gen Yers like managers who listen to us.
The first thing that they're looking for is they actually want to be listened to.
Avril Henry runs a human resources management consultancy in Australia.
The biggest complaint people under the age of 26, our Gen Ys, have about current managers in the workplace is that they don't listen to us. They think because we're young and we have less experience, we have nothing to offer. They are also, interestingly, the most technologically savvy generation in employment history. They know more about technology than veterans, boomers, and X put together.
And what do y'all expect to be able to do with all that knowledge?
Well, listen to this.
Gen Y just want to be the CEO tomorrow.
Avril Henry may have been kidding, but she's on to something. We Gen Yers aim high and have little patience for grunt work. Again, Paul Redmond.
Some employers are finding it hard to integrate Generation Ys into the workplace, particularly in the first few years when work is fairly routine. So employers are finding it hard to retain good Generation Y graduates because if they get bored, they tend to go.
And Rena Nadler says we hop from job to job because we don't want to get started in the wrong direction.
When a millennial leaves one job and goes to another, they tend to be thinking about how that will affect their long-term careers. And that's very different from, you know, what many employers see as the typical job hopping and really attribute to us, which is just moving from gig to gig because we have no institutional loyalty and don't really care.
Thinking about their long-term career at age 22? Isn't that a little early?
Heck, at age 22, most of us are halfway through our first 10-year plan. But Paul Redman advises young people to keep their long-term plans flexible.
They've come up from a very logical sort of view about careers, but keeping your options open is actually, you know, a career skill.
Okay, so Generation Yers do care about their jobs and their career paths, but they sure don't sound like it to their employers with their casual, informal emails and office behavior.
Maybe we just get straight to the point. That said, Avril Henry has some advice for us.
You need to understand the communication style of other generations and that it's more formal and less informal. So you need to learn more about the language to use when you are talking to the older generations.
And while millennials may not always communicate well to their employers, We like our managers to communicate to us how we're doing.
Gen Y want regular feedback. Well, not once a year in the performance appraisal process or even quarterly. They want to be told every week, you're doing a good job. Or if they're not doing a good job, tell me what I'm not doing well. So they're looking for that regular constructive feedback.
Okay, that's good advice for people who manage Gen Yers. What else should employers know?
Well, Paul Redmond says it's not always about the money.
What Generation Y seems to want is change. The idea that they're working for something that's important, that fits in with their value system. The idea that it's almost a noble calling is very important to Generation Y. And we're finding that some employers are discovering that just paying people more money isn't a great motivating force for Generation Y.
And we're looking to learn from good managers from the boomer generation, folks born right after World War II. Again, Rena Nadler.
Boomers respond really, really well to one-on-one relationships, and millennials really want to build mentorships with older adults. So this is a huge opportunity for workplaces to really pair older and younger workers and get the best out of both of them.
So which generation's perspective is best?
None of them are. As Avril Henry points out, no generation is right or wrong. We're just different.
We've had our expectations and our values created by different social, economic, political, and historical events. And so therefore, we need to understand the point of view and the position that each generation is coming from to be able to effectively communicate and work together.
That's a good point. I'll copy that down.
Don't bother. I have it in an MP3 file. For Generation Y, this is Lucas Lowerson.
And for Generation X and Science Careers, this is Kate Travis.
You can read more about Generation Y in the workplace in this week's Science Careers, www.sciencecareers.org.
Lucas, by the way, you did a great job helping me with this week's podcast.
Thanks for the feedback, Kate.
Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about why giving birdseed to birds may be a bad thing, how moths find their way in the dark, and finally, how, when it comes to pesticide resistance, mosquitoes get two for the price of one.
Well, let's start with birds. You mean my backyard feeder isn't doing the birds good?
Well, Rob, the point of this study is that your backyard feeder might be a mixed blessing for birds.
How so?
Well, believe it or not, in the United States and the UK alone, we dish out about 500,000 metric tons of bird seed a year. So that's a lot of bird seed going to feed all of these wild birds. And ecologists have rightly wondered, what sort of impact is this having on the environment? And so a team of researchers did a couple studies. First, they did a review of the literature to see sort of what was known about the effect of birdseed up to now. And they also did an experiment on their own. And the review showed that there are definitely some positives of birdseed, one being that the birds were healthier, also that they bred earlier and they had more offspring. So all that seems like good things. And in fact, the researchers confirmed this with their own study when they gave a group of blue tits peanuts, when they fed them peanuts, and then when they had another group of blue tits they didn't give peanuts to, the birds that were nibbling the peanuts all winter fledged a lot more chicks in the spring and did a lot better.
What's the downside then?
Well, the downside, as the researchers discovered when they reviewed some of the literature, was that healthier birds tend to lay eggs earlier. And when chicks hatch earlier, they often hatch before food is available. So that can be a bad thing for chicks.
So it's too cold for the food that the chicks need to survive?
That's what it sounds like. Another problem, which these studies hinted at, was that the birds that don't migrate for the winter, that are spending all winter in your backyard eating birdseed, are big competition to birds that have migrated and haven't been feasting on birdseed all winter. So when these migrating birds come back, they could potentially face some really stiff competition from these birds that are a lot healthier than they theoretically would be if the birdseed wasn't present.
What are ornithologists recommending then?
Well, it's tough because some of them, based on the study, are saying, I wouldn't recommend anybody feed birds birdseed because of the potential negative effects. But others say there's really still not enough evidence. Right now, it really looks like a mixed bag. There seems to be positive and negative effects. So they don't want to make strict recommendations based on just this one study.
Well, from how birds find their sustenance through the winter to how moths find their way in the dark. Why do moths need to find their way in the dark anyway?
Well, lots of insects migrate, but a lot of insects like dragonflies and butterflies tend to migrate during the day. And it's still a very impressive feat because a lot of times they're migrating, you know, thousands of kilometers. But during the day, it seems a little bit more intuitive how they might migrate. They could use the sun as a guide or they have visual landmarks. But for some reason, moths, and especially a moth called the silver Y moth, which is a big crop gobbler, tends to migrate at night. And this has really puzzled biologists because migrating at night seems inherently more risky. You have a lot less to go on, at least visually.
Is there some advantage to migrating at night?
Well, there's faster air currents that blow at night. So one potential advantage is that the moths may be able to get faster to their destination by migrating at night.
So how do the moths do it?
Well, to find out, researchers used vertical radar beams, and they tracked moths that were whizzing by about 150 meters overhead. They analyzed 42 mass migrations over two summers. And these migrations were from the United Kingdom to the Mediterranean, so migrations going in a southward direction. And the first interesting thing the researchers found was that the moths only tended to migrate when the wind was blowing southward, which makes sense, but it shows that the moths know which direction the wind is blowing, and they're only going to start migrating when the wind is blowing in a direction that's in the direction they want to go. But what was more interesting is that the researchers found that when the moths were in flight, they were all facing the same direction. And so that seemed to clue in that there was something going on a biological level in the moths, that they were all able to orient themselves in the same direction. Maybe they have a magnetic compass, or maybe they just have something genetic that's allowing them to know exactly which way to point. And even when the wind blew them off course, they were all able to reorient themselves in the right direction.
Well, what are scientists going to do with this information about nocturnal migrating moths?
Well, researchers are hoping that the data will help them predict future migrations, which are likely to increase as global warming increases. So it could be very useful information, especially for managing crops, because these guys are such big pests when it comes to crops.
Well, from crop pests to human pests, how are these mosquitoes so resistant to pesticides?
Well, Rob, this story has to do with the idea that we've been spraying so much pesticide and insecticide and, you know, to drive bugs away that over time, bugs like mosquitoes become resistant, just like bacteria become resistant to antibiotics. And what's interesting is sometimes mosquitoes can become resistant to more than one insecticide at a time, which sounds like a good thing if you're a mosquito, because obviously you want to be as resistant to as many insecticides as possible. But biologists have long thought it's actually a bad thing. And the reason is because these resistant mutations come with a cost. Yes, you become resistant to a pesticide, but the mutations often have deleterious effects when it comes to the rest of the mosquito biology.
Like what?
Like they can affect the nervous system or even affect the insect's metabolism. And these are problems that the insects deal with because they're getting the advantage of pesticide resistance. But biologists have thought the more resistance genes they have, the worse it would be for the insect. So it actually shouldn't be an advantage for an insect to have more than one resistance mutation.
But you said two for one. So that's not the case?
Right. And the way the researchers showed this was they got some mosquitoes, and they had mosquitoes that were resistant to a variety of insecticides. One class called pyrethroids and another class called organophosphates. So they had some mosquitoes that were just resistant to pyrethroids, some that were just resistant to organophosphates, some that were resistant to both, and some that weren't resistant at all.
A control.
A control, exactly. And as they expected, when they just grew these mosquitoes in a normal environment without insecticides, the mosquitoes that weren't resistant to anything did the best because they didn't have any of the deleterious mutations. And they didn't need them because there was no insecticide in the environment. And the mosquitoes that had resistance to the pyrethroids or the organophosphates didn't do quite as well. But what was interesting is that the biologists would have expected that the mosquitoes that had resistance to both would do worse of all. But in fact, they did just about the same as the insects that had resistance to just one or the other of the insecticides.
So the cost of the mutations didn't add up.
Exactly. They didn't add up. It wasn't any worse to have two than just to have one.
Are they somehow canceling one another out?
That's exactly what the researchers think is happening. One of the mutations the researchers know makes for a bit of a twitchy mosquito, so maybe like a hyper-nervous mosquito, while the other resistance mutation makes mosquitoes a little bit more sluggish. So you can imagine if you had both mutations, they would sort of cancel each other out and leave the mosquito not normal, but not any worse off than it was before. And so that's one possible explanation why having two mutations might not be any worse than just having one.
Were these super mosquitoes invincible?
No, and it turns out there actually is a downside to having both mutations. And that is that although they can resist each poison well enough by itself, when the poisons are combined, when the insecticides are combined, it takes a much lower dose to kill the mosquitoes. And that could be important for controlling these bugs when it comes to keeping them off of us.
All right. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into stories about how you can detect the presence of animals in water just by using a DNA test, how asbestos wreaks havoc on the lungs, and finally, how seawater gives clues to ancient meteor impacts. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can check out the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the April 11th, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.